It's not like sleep only affects one pathway, or exercise only affects one pathway, or nutrition only affects one pathway. These things affect multiple pathways at the same time and sort of really synergize such that small changes can have big impacts. Each of us is intelligent in a slightly different way, and each of us has the same capability to learn and engage with material that we're interested in. There's going to be some influence of the environment and the other things around us that will determine whether we're able to express and engage those tendencies or not.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. So friends, are you ready to join me? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, my brain is on fire in a good way after today's episode. I absolutely adore Dr. Tommy Wood's book, The Stimulated Mind, and was so excited to talk to him, and this conversation blew me away. Tommy's book is one of the most thorough, comprehensive, and inspirational books I have ever read when it comes to everything supporting your brain and warding off cognitive decline. Tommy is so kind, and we dived into so many incredible topics in today's conversation. Things like, what is the one thing to prevent dementia? What does intelligence actually mean? How can you boost memory and enhance focus? Should you multitask? How does AI affect the brain? And how should you engage with it in the most healthy way possible? How do alcohol, caffeine, and nicotine affect the brain? And so much more. Today's conversation will likely give you a whole new perspective on all things your mind. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/stimulatedmind. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about, so definitely check that out. I can't wait to hear what you guys think. Definitely let me know in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers. Intermittent fasting plus real foods plus life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. Hi friends, did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy-to-eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. All right, I think that's all the things. Without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with Dr. Tommy Wood. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation I am about to have. So the backstory on today's conversation, a few months ago now, one of my dear friends who has also been on the show, Andrew McConnell, check out that episode. He offered to introduce me to the incredible Dr. Tommy Wood for his book, The Stimulated Mind, Future-Proof Your Brain from Dementia and Stay Sharp at Any Age. And I was an immediate yes, obviously from the endorsement, but also just in general, I'm a little bit obsessed with all things the brain, which is kind of evident having a podcast. It's really because I just love learning. Like I could just learn all day, every day. And so anything about the what we do with our mind is an immediate yes for me. And then actually, Tommy, we booked you for the show. And then I think literally like maybe a week or so after you were on your Joe Rogan episode came as well, which was epic because I love that show. So then dove into the book and oh my goodness, friends, this is hands down. So I've done a lot of episodes on different aspects of brain health on this show. I do think this is the most comprehensive, probably the deepest dive, the most comprehensive. I was just blown away with everything in this book. So it covers all things brain aging, you know, the current science on dementia and Alzheimer's and all of that. And then all of the factors that affect the brain, the role of diet, the role of exercise, the role of literally retirement and social networks. And you learn all about memory and how we focus. And there's a love of planning and scheduling. So I was down with that. But there's just so much in here. My mind is blown appropriately enough. So yeah, I've been looking forward to this for so long. I have like 50 pages of notes here, but don't think we'll get to all of it. Tommy, thank you so much for all that you do. And thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you so much for reading the book. I'm really glad you enjoyed it. I will say that you know, you sent me a list of potential questions up front, and this is definitely the most well-researched list of questions I've ever been sent for a podcast. So I was super impressed with that. I doubt we can get through all of it, but hopefully we can tick off a number of these topics.
I love it so much. And spoiler, that was the toned down version. The original document was like three times as long. I will say, so really quickly, there were a few different moments where we had things like weirdly and similar in common. You liked musical theater. I'm like a huge musical theater person. And then also, I love that you keep your, I keep my temperature, my bedroom at 62 degrees exactly. That is like the perfect temperature. And I actually get in trouble with my apartment complex because they come and tell me I can't do that. I'm like, I'm paying for the air conditioner. I think I can. In any case, and there's a reason for that with keeping the room cold for your brain, but for your sleep. Regardless, to start things off, your personal story, which you do talk about a lot in the book. So we'll let listeners, you know, read the book to get your full picture. But did you have an epiphany? Nope. There's so many puns in this. Did you have an epiphany someday about your interest in brain health? What led you to actually doing all of this work today?
That's a great question. And in reality, there was no big epiphany. I woke up one day a few years ago and I realized, oh, hey, I'm a neuroscientist and I'm an expert in the brain. And I just sort of like this, like just happened over time. So I did most of my academic training in the UK, undergraduate degree, medical degree, worked as a doctor for a couple of years before doing a PhD in physiology and neuroscience in Norway, actually at the University of Oslo. And that PhD came about because of lab I did some work in when I was an undergrad. It was a friend of my mum's. She was a professor who had a lab, and I spent a couple of summers working in that lab. And it was a neuroscience lab, and we were looking at ways to treat babies with brain injury. That's something that my lab at the University of Washington still does. I'm an associate professor there. But I never really planned to get into neuroscience. This was just kind of something to do a little bit of research, as you often do when you're as an undergrad. But sort of alongside my clinical work, training as a doctor, my sort of formal academic work, working in the lab, I also was very interested in athletic performance and working with athletes. So I was a rower in college. I was head coach of the Oxford Medical School Boat Club and coached a lot of rowers. And then during my PhD, I started I helped build a startup company that worked with athletes of various levels, you know, from sort of weekend warriors through to world champions and Olympians in various sports, just trying to help all aspects of their health and performance. We did blood work, we did stool tests, we did urine tests. We looked at all aspects of training and lifestyle to try and see how we could help people's performance. And that sort of has continued over time. Right now, most of the work I do with athletes is in Formula One. But sort of I had these two parallel tracks. One was sort of like very formal clinical academic. The other one was sort of applied, you know, working with athletes. And sort of I'm doing the work in these various fields, I sort of saw the same stuff again and again and again. And then a lot of the stuff I was doing, working on, you know, physical performance, cognitive performance in athletes, mapped very closely onto the stuff I was doing related to injury treatment or prevention, dementia prevention. And sort of all of it came together and made me realize that actually everything that I was doing in one way or another related to brain health. And so that was kind of, those things came together, and now my lab and academic work and, you know, writing the book and podcasts and things like that sort of have brought all those different strands together, hopefully in ways so that I can translate some of the science of what we know about brain health to help people improve how their brain functions on a day-to-day basis, and then ideally long-term decrease the risk of dementia. But it was really this sort of, I was just doing the things that I was interested in. And all of a sudden I just realized that, hey, I'm sort of become an expert in brain health almost by accident.
I love it. And interestingly enough, so it's kind of like a metaphor in a way for the book, because so the idea that there are all these different things that aren't necessarily the one thing, but then they all relate it together. And you realize you're a neuroscientist. It's like the theme of the book, one of the themes of the book, which is that there are all these different factors that affect brain health, and there's not one thing, but they all, you know, come together and affect each other, and, you know, that's more beneficial. Realizing, like, I think you say something about like zooming out rather than zooming in. So like, we tend to be really reductionist, and because you say in the book about how like with F1 that they always want to know what's the one thing to do. Is that like the question you still get a lot? Like, what is the one thing to do for brain health?
That is a question that I get a lot, and I do quite like it as a question, because the alternative is what we often see, you know, in books, in podcasts, on social media, which is, here's a list of 20 things to do. And I think one of the reasons why Andrew and I, who you mentioned, one of the reasons why he and I got along so well is because, you know, the work that his company is doing realizes that if you tell people 20 things, they'll do zero things. Whereas if you can find that one thing that you think is going to move the needle, that they feel good about, they feel it's doable, then sort of like this whole system shifts in your favor, because you're really, when you're doing one thing, you're actually doing many things, because it's not like sleep only affects one pathway, or exercise only affects one pathway, or nutrition only affects one pathway. These things affect multiple pathways at the same time, and sort of really synergize such that small changes can have big impacts. So yeah, a lot of the work that I do, especially in that kind of environment where people are so time limited, which is actually very similar to the rest of us, right? We're all very time limited, and we're all trying to figure out how we can feel better and perform better, but ideally without it being overwhelming or unsustainable. And so then it really comes down to thinking about, where can we have some impact in something that, at least to start with, isn't going to create a lot of friction, is very doable, somebody's going to enjoy, and or is sustainable. Because we know from there, it can have a really big knock-on effect. So that's what I spend a lot of my time doing, is sort of refining down a massive, you know, possible list of things to do, to just like one thing that somebody can start to move the needle on.
It's so interesting, especially you have a section where you talk about kind of within different categories, you know, if you were to do one thing. So, you know, like in diet, and this is not a takeaway of the episode. The takeaway is not eat sardines. Like, I promise.
I think that's a good, it is a good takeaway, but.
I mean, it could be eat sardines, but you know, like a really practical, implementable thing that within these different categories that people could do. Talk about, and I'm not sure like when this comes up in the book, and it might come up multiple times, but you say something, and I'm paraphrasing, to the effect of like the importance of us, of our brain engaging in the world. Again, the book is called The Stimulated Mind. So there's this concept of the engagement of the brain and the brain being stimulated. And then the like a sentence or like an explanation of it was that it gives the brain, like as long as the brain has like is engaged and has a purpose, then it has a purpose to keep going. Does it really work that way? Like, does the brain really, when I was reading the book, I was getting so in my head, like thinking about thinking and everything. But do you think there is that purpose in the brain where just being engaged and stimulated is a reason that it would be anti-aging, because it's going to keep going and engaging?
Yes. I think you can boil it down that far, or at least some version of that. And this is true, actually, of pretty much any tissue in the body. So the function of tissues, and we could be talking about bones, we can be talking about muscles, we can talk about your heart, your liver, your immune system. Their function is driven by the demands that are placed on them, or the stimuli that they're exposed to, right? So we know that's the case for, right, if you want to get bigger and stronger, you lift weights. If you want to improve like cardiac efficiency, you do some kind of cardiovascular training. If you want to improve the strength of bones, right, then axial loading, right, again, weights, really important. The immune system responds to stimuli like infections or vaccines. The liver improves its ability to deal with toxins like alcohol. If they're exposed to toxins like alcohol, that's not like a recommendation that you should drink more alcohol to make your liver function better. But you know what I mean? Like your body responds to these challenges by improving its function in that area. And the brain is essentially the same. Many of the biochemical pathways that you see in muscle tissue in response to exercise are actually very similar to the biochemical pathways activated in the brain when you stimulate brain networks. And a few years ago now, a friend of mine, a good friend and colleague, Josh Turkner, who's a neurologist, we wrote a paper basically outlining this idea that one of the primary reasons why we lose cognitive function with age is because we stop using our brains in a way that challenges them, because it's that challenge that builds capacity. And we see this early in life. So education and educational attainment, probably the biggest predictors of early life gains in cognitive function. And then how we use our brains as we get older determines how or whether they decline. So people who do more cognitively stimulating work or engage in more cognitively stimulating hobbies and activities, they're more socially engaged, or they feel like they have purpose. Their brains age less and decline less over time. And this is because you're continuing to stimulate them. On the other side, if you remove stimulus, just like you stop training, right? If you stop going to the gym, you'll lose muscle mass, you'll lose strength. And the brain essentially seems to be the same, because if we're no longer stimulating the connections between neurons and all the other cells in the brain, then those connections become weaker. They start to be removed, just like muscle mass starts to be removed if we don't use it. And then that can precipitate a decline in function. So really, this huge primary driver of how our brains function on a day-to-day basis is what we engage with, how we engage our brains, and how we challenge and stimulate them, which builds and then maintains function over time.
It's so fascinating. And I guess the layer that I feel adds complexity, because it's interesting comparing it, you're saying, you know, to all the different tissues in the body. Presumably, I'm thinking about it, just confirming in my head, presumably all the other tissues that are not conscious don't really like have a, they just respond, right? Like they just do the thing when stimulated. And the brain though could choose not to, you know, like given the stimuli that it faces. Like we have to actually want to engage. So is it like the one tissue where it faces the things, but it can decide just not to engage?
So that's absolutely true. And I think that the primary reason for having a brain is to promote and ensure survival of the body. And, you know, from there, you know, the survival of your genetic line, be that either through reproduction or in post-reproductive years, looking after your progeny and children and community. There's lots about human evolution that suggests that it's not just about reproduction, it's also about supporting those who you're related to later in life. So if it's kind of a survival mechanism, you can see that early in life, children and adolescents, or with a developing brain, it's constantly seeking input, right? It's constantly seeking to learn from and be challenged by the environment, right? Kids are always testing the limits, be that physical or, you know, what they can get away with. And they're constantly trying to learn movement and social connection and language and trying and failing and learning from there. This, I think, is this, you know, a fundamental driver of human engagement, is trying to gather information, especially social information, but trying to gather information from the environment in order to maximize the likelihood of survival. Part of the problem, though, is that at the same time, we are in some way hardwired to minimize unnecessary energy or effort expenditure, right? Because evolutionarily, that wasn't really an option that we had available to us. We had to do a lot of physical work to gather food, and we had to do a lot of physical work or cognitive work to, you know, keep our tribe alive and pass on the knowledge that we had, right? This is one of the uses of older adults in sort of the history of humanity. And so if we're trying to balance our efforts in the modern environment, we can now get away with not exercising. We can get away with not doing cognitively challenging stuff, because really our environment doesn't demand it of us. And we've gotten to a point now where we have to actively seek it out, because we're even though the brain is primed to try and get important information in order to adapt and survive, we've created an environment where that's not necessary to that's not necessary for survival. So we're kind of battling two drivers at the same time. And just like we've engineered movement out of the physical environment, so we've had to invent exercise, we've now also gotten to the point that we've engineered out cognitive challenges in on many fronts, so that we now have to go and seek those out as well. So I think that there's this fine balance between what our brains thrive on in order to build and maintain capacity, and what the modern environment actually requires us to do for survival on a day-to-day basis. And those things may not necessarily be aligned. However, just like physical activity is sort of the requirement for physical activity is like hard-coded into our physiology. Like, our bodies require physical movement in order to function at their best. And, you know, we can measure that as being anti-aging. Physical activity is probably the one thing that either prevents or reverses all of the documented hallmarks of aging. But so it's a basic requirement of our physiology. And now I think we've gotten to this point where cognitive inputs are becoming engineered out of the environment that we have to physically engage or seek them out, because they're not as necessary as they were historically. But again, in order for the tissue to function at its best, your brain to function at its best, these are the core things that you really need in order to build and maintain first the structure and then the function that comes with it.
Yeah, and especially with things like AI, which we can definitely circle back to. A quick question before that. I'm really curious how level of intelligence relates to that. So I'm really, really fascinated by intelligence. And so when was this? Maybe like a decade ago, there was because I mentioned like musical theater in the beginning. So I went to film and theater school. So I saw a casting for a game show and you had to be in Mensa for it. And so I went down a Mensa rabbit hole and I like revisited the intelligence test like as an adult. And I started taking the test and I was like, oh, this is like so... It seemed like it was just a pattern. I was like, I could easily figure out how to take this test. Like, I don't understand how this is measuring intelligence once you know how the test works. But my point is, I'm really, really intrigued by intelligence. I'm intrigued by, like, are you born with a certain IQ? Does it change? You talk about something called crystallized intelligence in the book. Bringing it back to what we were just talking about, I think there's this stereotype out there where people who are super intelligent, people who are, you know, really high IQ, that they're always like thinking and learning and all the things. So do you know if intelligence correlates to the drive to be intelligent? Does it like self-sustain itself for some reason? Or can you be really intelligent and like not really though think a lot?
So the funny thing about all of this, well, there are many funny things about all of this. I think one of the most interesting things you realize when you spend a lot of time looking at cognitive function, and I'm using that very, very broadly on purpose, is that it's really hard to measure it. Like, what even is it? What is intelligence? And you could ask a dozen cognitive neuroscientists what intelligence is, and they'll give you a dozen different answers. And so, historically, we have thought that intelligence was synonymous with IQ, right? The intelligence quotient. But IQ is one very specific thing. And it's usually, like you mentioned, it's essentially some version of nonverbal reasoning that involves a lot of pattern recognition. But maybe some of the tests include arithmetic or, you know, basic math, some other things like that. And just the ability to do that quickly. But a lot of it is sort of like reasoning of some kind. Those tests were developed initially, or one of the reasons those tests were applied was to show that men were smarter than women.
Oh.
The history of the IQ test is both sexist and racist. IQ tests were essentially designed to show that white men were smarter than everybody else. And anybody's welcome to look this up. I realize that's a potentially inflammatory thing to say, but that's kind of the core of what these tests were. But the reason why you know, you go 100 years back in time. Or the reason why white men were better at these tests is because they were the ones who got to go to school, and they were the ones who learned how to do these kinds of tests. So part of the reason that it's hard to measure intelligence is because, first of all, we have to decide what intelligence is. And I would argue that each of us are intelligent in very different ways. And intelligence shouldn't be just boiled down to the ability to do some kind of reasoning task, because it could be related to artistic talents or linguistic talents or social talents, which you're obviously very different, but are all very important. And so when you look at these traditional tests, the people who do best are the people who get to go to school and spend more time in school because they get better at taking tests. That's one of the reasons. That's one of the reasons for that. But when you sort of step back a little bit, you see that there are some core functions of the brain that all of us would hope to have: the ability to process information quickly, the ability to make decisions when we need to, the ability to kind of, you know, control our thoughts and emotions, the ability to remember things on a day-to-day basis, whether that's sort of semantic knowledge or episodic memory, so remembering things that have happened to us. You do see that those people who spend more time engaged in cognitively stimulating activities do tend to be better at those things. They tend to have faster processing speed. They tend to be better at certain aspects of memory or focus. And that's just because engaging in cognitively challenging things requires you to learn how to focus. There's this thing called learning to learn. You learn how to engage with material such that you retain it, and it helps build capacity in the brain. So I think that inherently all of us have a desire to learn. It's just that we have not always been given the same opportunity and environment in which to learn. It's not that I think that smart people or people with a higher IQ are just inherently driven to learn things more or better. I think it's probably largely to do with the environment that that person has been in terms of the opportunities that they're given to learn, whether they're given the belief of being able to learn, whether they're, you know, kind of supported in those endeavors and, you know, have all the other things that we know support the building of capacity. So high quality nutrition, sleep, psychological safety, incredibly important. So you're actually investing time in, you know, future outcomes rather than just focusing purely on short-term survival. And this is why socioeconomic status and other things play a big role in our, you know, various aspects of cognitive function and risk of dementia. So I like to think that each of us is intelligent in a slightly different way, and each of us has the same capability to learn and engage with material that we're interested in. There's going to be some influence of the environment and the other things around us that will determine whether we're able to express and engage those tendencies or not.
Hey, friends. Did you know there is an ancient botanical that modern research shows performs on a level comparable to metformin when it comes to supporting healthy blood sugar levels? And not only that, this compound also supports the gut microbiome, healthy cholesterol levels, and even stimulates the AMPK pathway in the body to support cellular cleanup and longevity. You might have heard about AMPK. We talk about it a lot in the context of fasting, which also stimulates it. I am talking about berberine. I take berberine every single day of my life, and I see massive differences on my CGM, my continuous glucose monitor, when I use it. I take it to support my fast and before meals to reduce blood sugar levels. It is a powerhouse of a compound. And like I said, people are prescribed the pharmaceutical metformin to control their blood sugar levels when they could be taking this completely natural compound that has been used for thousands of years in both ancient traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. I wanted to make the best berberine on the market, so that's why I created AvalonX Berberine 500. We did so much testing to find the most potent, pure, and clean form available. There's no problematic fillers, no common allergens, just pure, vegan, lab-tested berberine, extracted from traditional sources. Friends, I am not kidding the difference I see on my blood sugar levels with this berberine. We're talking no post-meal spikes when I eat all that fruit and lower fasting blood sugar levels. It also reduced my HbA1c and my cholesterol levels. You can get it at avalonx.us. And the coupon code IFPODCAST will get you 10% off. You can also get a one-time 20% off coupon code when you text AvalonX to 877-861-8318. That's AvalonX to 877-861-8318. And you can get a 15% off coupon code by signing up for email updates. For that, just go to avalonx.us/email list. Again, friends, this is one of the most powerful compounds you can add into your health and wellness routine. Healthy blood sugar control, even if you're not pre-diabetic or diabetic, is so important, and berberine helps support that. It is the ultimate compound for blood sugar control, cholesterol, your gut microbiome, and longevity. Get it at avalonx.us with the coupon code IFPODCAST.
I'm thinking about my grandfather, who he was completely brilliant. He ended up being a math professor. But he had some sort of learning disability. So they thought he was, well, I guess it's politically incorrect to say now, but they literally thought he was retarded. And so they wouldn't send him to school. So he just taught himself to read like himself, which is like mind blowing. So I guess there it was him rather than being supported. It was him not being supported. So he had to, you know, do it himself. It's interesting too what you're saying about the IQ test and the men and women, because one of the things you talk about in the book is, you know, why do more women get Alzheimer's when the, you know, we live on average, I think, 4 or 6 years longer. So you say that doesn't explain the gap there. And so did you say that one of the potential things could be like the historic role of women as homemakers and lack of like the jobs that they're exposed to and things like that?
Yeah, I think so. There are, just to kind of put some numbers on this, about two-thirds of the burden of Alzheimer's disease is in women compared to a third in men. Alzheimer's disease makes up 60 to 80% of the cases of dementia. So the dementia burden overall is larger in women than it is in men. And there's a number of biological reasons why this may be the case. So there are basic differences in how male and female cells respond to things like inflammation and oxidative stress. And that happens in a petri dish, regardless of, outside of the influence of hormones and things like that. This is stuff that they've studied in many labs, including my lab. Just like there's some basic fundamental differences just based on the genes and proteins that are expressed on the X versus the Y chromosome. And that, that's why men tend to age a little faster. Men tend to be a little bit more susceptible to oxidative stress, for example. And we also know that the burden of neurological diseases is different in women and men. Like men are more likely to get strokes. Women are more likely to get depression and migraines and Alzheimer's disease. Of course, you can get any of those regardless of sex, but there is a difference in burden. And part of that may be because there are certain genes related to brain structure and cells in the brain that are on the X chromosome, such as some related to white matter in the brain. And white matter is very susceptible to the processes of aging. White matter structure changes with age, and that sort of tracks quite closely with cognitive decline. So the balance of those genes, the expression of those genes is slightly different in women compared to men. That may contribute to the different burden of Alzheimer's in women. Obviously, there's the hormonal differences. That certainly plays a role too. But beyond that, I do think, the premise of my book is that how we use our brains and the environment that we engage with and or are exposed to is a significant contributor to our cognitive function and cognitive decline. And we know that higher educational attainment is associated with a lower risk of dementia. Higher cognitive engagement and cognitive activity later in life is associated with a slower rate of cognitive decline, and again, a lower risk of dementia. And this, we've known for several decades now. There's a classic study that I talk about in the book called the Seattle Longitudinal Study. So it was done here at the University of Washington, where I work. And what they did for the first time, pretty much the first time on a large scale, was look at the same people over several decades. So they would bring them back every 7 years. They would measure their cognitive function. They looked at things like their physical health. They looked at their home and work and social environment. And this was back in starting in the 50s. You know, so this research back then was really quite groundbreaking. And what they found was that the majority of people, so more than 50%, maintained cognitive function from their 50s into their 80s. And this is not what we expect. We just expect that people will lose function over that time. And some people do lose function, but the majority of people, more than 50%, did maintain function. And those data were actually used to raise the retirement age in the US in the 1980s, just because they found out that, hey, when you reach 60, actually, you're not going to suddenly lose all your cognitive function, which is what was assumed before then. But in one of the studies from the Seattle Longitudinal Study, or one of the main things they found was something that they called environmental complexity was one of the best predictors of whether you would maintain cognitive function, you know, over several decades. And environmental complexity was based on your education, your social environment, and your work environment primarily. And then they classified people into different groups based on their level of environmental complexity. And what they found was that homemakers, as they called them, which traditionally has been women, tended to have the least level of social, educational, and cognitive or work-based engagement. They tended to be more isolated, and they tended to have a faster rate of cognitive decline. This is not a comment on people who are like stay-at-home parents, right? That can be very stimulating. It can be very important. It can be very fulfilling. But in this study, back in the 50s, that was what they found, that women who are primarily at home alone during the day tended to suffer more cognitive decline over time. And they felt that was because they weren't getting the same level of cognitive engagement and stimulus that, say, their husbands were getting from the work, you know, going out and being part of the workforce. And when you think about the traditional role of women in society, they have, you know, maybe more likely to, you know, stay at home. So less likely to be part of the workforce, less likely to get access to education. And both of those things we know are protective against dementia. So the majority of women who've experienced dementia up to this point, who've contributed to the statistics I gave you previously, existed in a society where women got less education and they had less access to the workforce. And that really started to switch in the 70s. And now it's almost flipped, where now slightly more women get higher levels of education and participate in the workforce compared to men. But that only happened in the late 1980s. So I do think that a big part of our historical dementia burden in women may be driven by the lack of equitable access to the workforce and to education for women. And I'm hopeful that with changes in society over the past, you know, 4 or 5 decades, that will actually improve and that will decrease the relative burden of dementia in women compared to men. The other things are going to matter too, right? Hormones, health, other things are going to play a role. But I'm hopeful that a more equitable society will allow some of those numbers to shift.
Oh, wow. So I guess it would be my generation. I was born in 1990, so right after the 80s. It would be around my generation where we could start seeing if that's panning out, like when my generation becomes that age.
Absolutely. And I will say, it's hard to figure out the exact reasons why. And I think there are many reasons why. But when you look at the most recent statistics on dementia, yes, the overall burden of dementia is expected to increase over the coming decades. But right now, at any given age, so say at like 65 years old or 70 years old, you are less likely to be diagnosed with dementia than pretty much any other time in recent history. So if you're 70 now, you're less likely to be diagnosed with dementia than if you were 70 20 years ago. And so this is what we call age-specific incidence of dementia. And that has been decreasing over the past sort of 70 or 80 years or so. In multiple populations, they've looked at this in populations in the US. They've looked at it in populations in Europe. And I think one reason for that could be a change in societal sort of equity in those countries. But other things have improved as well, right? Physical health has improved. We've gotten better at treating cardiovascular disease. And that's certainly played a big role as well, because cardiovascular disease directly affects dementia risk too. But we are seeing some positive shifts in age-specific incidence of dementia. And it could be that those sort of societal shifts are driving parts of that.
Awesome. Well, that's promising. And then your work is continuing to help that as well. One little quick comment, because you were mentioning the white matter and everything. So I got actually really stressed out by this, because you mentioned early in the book about, you know, you question how applicable rodent studies are for human studies on, especially on this topic. And you mentioned at one point that, so a rodent's brain is only 10% white matter and a human's is 60%. Is that?
Yes. So rodents are less than 10%. Humans are more, you know, at least 60% or more.
That really stressed me out, because I was like, wait a minute. I don't know if I can trust any rodent study anymore. If it's that different, like that's a big deal. It's kind of like when we study the fasting, like fasting in rodents, and you compare like a 24-hour fast in a rodent to, you know, a 24-hour fast in a human. I'm like, that's not the same thing to them.
So I say this as somebody who, I've done a lot of rodent studies in my life. We still do some in my lab occasionally, although less and less, because rodent studies on the whole just have not translated to improved treatment, you know, particularly for neurological disease in humans. And I think a lot of that is fundamentally our brains are so much more complex and structured differently compared to rodent brains. And this is something I learned, you know, very early on during my PhD, like how little really the work that's done in rodents translates to useful interventions and treatments in humans. And so as an example in Alzheimer's disease, right? Mice don't get Alzheimer's disease. So we have to insert a bunch of genetic mutations that cause them to accumulate amyloid. You know, assuming that the amyloid cascade hypothesis the amyloid cascade is the primary driver of Alzheimer's, which it's certainly part of it, but I think there's a lot more going on as well. And most people would probably agree on that at this point. But what's interesting that they found in mice is that in humans, there was this thought that amyloid accumulates, that triggers the accumulation of hyperphosphorylated tau. So we're talking amyloid plaques, tau tangles. These are sort of the core neuropathological hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. If you fill a mouse's brain with amyloid, they don't generate any tau whatsoever. So again, there are just like these core processes that we see happening in humans that just do not happen in rodents. We have to kind of force it to happen. And then, you know, even some of the downstream effects still don't happen. So that doesn't mean that like all mouse studies are entirely useless. I think some of them, if you really know what you're trying to model and you're confident that what is happening in the rodent is truly what happens in humans, and there are some examples of that, then I think they can be useful. But whenever I see anything, anybody says anything, relate, you know, it's in the newspaper, it's on a podcast, somebody says this thing, you know, this thing happened in a mouse study, therefore this may mean this for humans, I immediately ignore it, because I know that 99.99% of stuff that happens in mice just won't happen in humans. That 0.01% can still be useful, but we just need to acknowledge that the vast majority of what happens in mouse studies in the lab is never going to be relevant to us as humans. And that makes that work difficult and frustrating. It can still be important, but it just, I think we really have to put that in perspective, especially when we're then trying to translate that into what we should do, you know, on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I have one last animal comment, but before that, if listeners are interested in the amyloid hypothesis, I think reading your book is the most, it's my example of like the most inspiring, like feel really great about the brain and the things that you can do. The correlate to that on the flip side, and not because it's a bad book, it's just it'll make you feel a little bit. I interviewed Charles Piller, who is the one who he's the science journalist who broke all of the, he found all of the fraud in Alzheimer's data research. And reading that book and interviewing him, I just walked away being, I really recommend the book, but I just walked away being like, oh my goodness, I was so sad. Like if listeners would like to learn more about the Alzheimer's history, definitely check out that episode. Okay, so rodents don't get dementia. I know you said in the book that apes don't either. Do any animals, like do pets, do domesticated animals?
No. So another really good, so you're talking about Doctored was his book, right?
Yes.
And There's another very good book, and I really recommend, if you can find a podcast with a guy called Carl Herrup.
What is it? What's his name?
Carl, K-A-R-L, Herrup, H-E-R-R-U-P. And he wrote a book called How Not to Study a Disease. And it's the history of Alzheimer's disease. I think we've seen this again and again and again, where in the Alzheimer's field, we've become so hyper-focused on one particular mechanism that it's held us back in terms of being able to really understand the full disease process and where we can intervene. So what, you know, I talk about in my book is that, yes, there are many ways that, you know, amyloid probably play and tau play a role. There are many other things going on at the same time. All of the things that we can do, of which there is a ton of stuff that we can do to improve our cognitive function on a day-to-day basis, decrease our risk of dementia, they act through a variety of different pathways. And, you know, some of that is amyloid, but some of it is other things too. I think that the reason why I wanted to write a very positive book is because I think that there is a lot of hope, but we have to acknowledge that we've made some missteps that have made us sort of become first hyper-focused on one pathway, and then, you know, uncovering some of the fraud in the history of the amyloid hypothesis, you know, made us feel, you know, very disheartened about what we might do. But in reality, actually, we don't need to know the mechanisms because we know what works. We know what decreases dementia risk. We can get into the mechanisms if we find that interesting, but actually we don't even need to know them. And we may never fully learn them. But to actually answer your question, and the reason why I started with Carl Herrup is because he says this in his book. He says there are two things that need to be in place for you to get Alzheimer's disease. First, you need to be old. And second, you need to be human, because there are no other species, you know, have that sort of same process, you know, exactly the way that we do. There are some kind of parallel processes. So non-human primates may accumulate some types of pathological changes. In dogs, you see some elements of brain changing, of some elements of brain change with aging, like some changes in white matter, but you don't see that kind of full comprehensive process in any other species.
Oh my goodness. Do you think AI could get dementia?
So no, I don't think AI can get dementia, but I think it could display cognitive elements of cognitive decline. And there was one recent study that actually did this. What happened was they trained a large language model in multiple rounds. And every time what they did is they trained the next generation of the algorithm with the outputs of the previous generation. And so over time, the quality of the cognitive function, or the quality of the outputs, because it's not truly cognitive function, but the quality of the outputs declined, because you basically ended up feeding AI its own slop and it got like dumber over time.
Hey friends, I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com.
Yeah, I definitely have a lot of questions about AI. This is one of the, okay, so when I'm like taking all my notes, it's funny, I'll come up with like I'll have a question for you and I'll like put a big star, like if you ask one question, ask this question. But then like 30 minutes later, I'm like, if you ask one question, ask this question. Basically, I have a lot of questions that have haunted me for a while. And one of them, and it relates to the modern world and everything, because you mentioned earlier how we're engaging now and that we have to create stimuli for our brain. I'm so perplexed. And I think I had this question going into your book. I've had it for a long time. You have a very long, in a good way, like a very thorough, that's a better word. You have a very thorough section on the modern world and multitasking. I think after reading that, I kind of get it, but I would like to hear you articulate it, which is when I think about the concept of multitasking, it seems like something that is very stimulating to the mind. And I've always wondered why, because you always hear, don't multitask. It's not good. You're not as productive. It's not blah, blah, blah. It's bad for you. But I've always been like, but why? Like, it seems very stimulating to my mind. That's how I've casually thought about it. Why is multitasking both a high cognitive load and, or how does it relate to cognitive decline?
The most important place to start is by differentiating between busyness and true, like, cognitive challenge, right? Because in the modern world, this is one reason why I quite like the title of my book. I think it's slightly provocative, and I won't take credit for it. It was actually my editor who came up with the name for the book. We are simultaneously overstimulated and understimulated. We're overstimulated in terms of the multitasking, task switching, endless access to information, being contacted, being required to respond. And at the same time, we're understimulated in terms of the true, deep, focused learning and challenge that's what drives, you know, cognitive function and you know, maintains brain structure. So we're doing a lot of stuff at the same time, but we're doing less of one hard thing at a time. And like one hard thing at a time is what really seems to build function, because it requires all of our focused attention. It drives neuroplasticity, often through the processes of failure, which drives learning, that builds structure, that builds function. So we're not learning languages, learning musical instruments, learning complex skills, but we are doing a ton of emails and Slack and Zoom and Instagram all at the same time. And I think that those two types of challenge are fundamentally different. We feel busy with both, but they have slightly different physiological and cognitive effects. So the first thing to realize is that in the grand scheme of things, human thought processes are actually very slow. We like to think that our brains are sort of these incredibly fast computational machines, and they are, but most of what your brain is doing is filtering out everything that you're exposed to so that you have just like one set of things that you can actually process and engage with at a time. So I referenced this paper that came out a couple of years ago called The Unbearable Slowness of Being, which basically estimates that the speed of human thought is 10 bits per second, a bit being a one or a zero in like computer code, right? So it's 10 ones and zeros per second you can process. And you know, we're including like visual information, auditory information, all that kind of stuff. And they have a number of different areas where they show that. So even people who are expressing like the most impressive human complex skills, they're still only processing information or enacting on that information at about 10 bits per second. The rest of what your brain is doing is filtering out huge amounts of information so that you can process those 10 bits. And they liken the difference between the speed of processing that the human brain is capable of, like truly engaging with, versus the amount of information that the brain is exposed to through, you know, our senses, our eyes, all those different things, as the amount of water that one person can drink relative to the water flowing through the Hoover Dam. Like that's how much everything is compressed down so that you can just like process it and engage with it. So this then, I think, helps us to realize that our brains don't actually work that quickly. In fact, they even make a joke like, you know, we've been trying to do these human like brain computer interfaces, and they're talking about fancier and fancier technology, you know, to kind of direct huge amounts of information to and away from the brain. But they kind of joke that actually, if you connected to the right place, you could just use like an old telephone cable, because that would be enough information for the. It's like your brain is as fast as dial up; it doesn't need to be broadband. This then, I think, reframes things so that we can appreciate that actually there's only so much information that we can process at any given time. And so, when you're multitasking, what you're doing, it has a very specific definition. Multitasking is doing two completely separate tasks, both of which, or you know, it could be more tasks, but like say it's two, or more than one task, where each task requires your focus and attention in order to perform it at its best. Because I've heard some people say, well, of course you can multitask because you can talk and walk at the same time. But like walking has become automated. It doesn't, you don't have to like focus on where you put your feet in order for walking to happen, right? And you know, some people have said, oh, well, you can watch TV and eat at the same time. And yes, that's technically true. But there are lots of studies that show that if you watch TV while you eat, you overeat because you're not actually paying attention to what you're eating, right? So you're kind of doing two things at the same time, but you do less well at each of them, because you're focusing on something else at the same time. And that's what we call a multitasking cost. So when you're doing multiple things at the same time, all of which that require your focused attention in order to perform them, you will do each of them less well than if you had done them one at a time. You then also lose the ability to be fully engaged with it such that you can learn from it, you know, through the processes of like driving neuroplasticity and failure, because you're not really focused on it. And right, that requires focus to kind of open the gates of neuroplasticity. At the same time, you're doing them less well, and that becomes inherently stressful. So there's lots of work by psychologist Gloria Mark. I talk about her a lot. She has a great book called Attention Span. And she's basically shown that in the work environment, if you're multitasking or task switching, which is often what we're doing, like going from Zoom to emails and back again. And, you know, if you try that, you realize that you're not really paying attention to the conversation on the Zoom call, but then also you're not really paying attention to the sentences you're writing in your email. And like, as you bounce back and forth, every time you bounce back and forth, you sort of like lose a step as you try and re-engage with the other task. And so you do neither of those things well. And that is inherently stressful. And they've sort of measured that with HRV and heart rates and things like that. So constantly bouncing back and forth between tasks or trying to do multiple tasks at the same time becomes inherently stressful, which then also can make you feel less productive, because actually the work that you did was lower quality and you never had the chance to like truly engage your brain in something challenging, which is something that our brains actually enjoy. We enjoy being challenged. We enjoy overcoming challenges. It makes us feel inherently good, but we don't actually get a chance to do that if we're constantly sort of multitasking and bouncing back and forth between things. And then the final part of this is that we can get better at multitasking. And there are studies that kind of suggest that people who do a lot of multitasking get better, or that there's less of a multitasking cost. So they can maintain function in two tasks slightly better. They still do worse than if they were doing them one at a time, but they have less of a total cost. But people who multitask a lot seem to also be more distractible, because your brain is you've no longer trained your brain to focus on one task at a time. You've trained it to focus on lots of things at the same time. So then it becomes less good at filtering out distractions, and it becomes less good at actually being able to just focus on one thing at a time. So there are certainly situations where you can multitask, you can get multiple things at the same time, done at the same time. The multitasking cost doesn't cost anything, because you can still do all your tasks more efficiently to a desired level of quality. There are certainly some combination of tasks where that's the case. But I would argue that for most times when we're either flip-flopping back and forth between tasks, or task switching, or multitasking, we're generally increasing stress, we're increasing error rate. That's also been shown. If we multitask or we're interrupted during our tasks by notifications or somebody else demanding something from our time, new emails coming in, then we have an increased risk of errors, or we have increased errors. So we have more errors, more stress, and less productivity, with like the quality of the work decreasing. So this isn't meant to be like all bad news. Like it's just to help people understand that some of the things that they're doing that they think is increasing efficiency because they're doing multiple things at the same time may actually not be doing that. It may be decreasing their productivity and decreasing their efficiency, and they would just be better off doing things one after the other. And they use the same amount of time to do that work, but actually the work is a higher quality and is maybe even done faster. So it's just kind of understanding that the brain isn't necessarily as capable sometimes as we expect it to be. And then just appreciating that sometimes we can do a better job if we just do one thing at a time.
Yeah. After reading that whole section, I really started noticing in myself some of the things that you mentioned that happen when people are, quote, multitasking. Like you talk about the, is it cognitive residue? I feel like I can like feel it now when I switch. I'm like, there's the cognitive residue from the prior task, and like the cognitive downtime, or like the, you know, the amount of time it takes to actually restart the new thing. And I've become super aware, because you've talked about the evolution of how quick we now want to like switch and focus on something else compared to how it used to be. And it's wild. Like when you're trying to focus, it's like, where does that thought even come from? Like I'll be like focusing on something, and then I just get this urge, like this crystal clear urge to like switch to something else. And it's like, where, and I have to ignore it. It's kind of like doing meditation. Yeah, it's fascinating, but I think that's really powerful. Like just being aware of what it's actually doing, and then, you know, how you can best engage in it. And something that I found works really well for me for how I structure work, because there is the, is it Pomodoro? Is that how you say?
Pomodoro.
Pomodoro method, which is like 20 minutes, I think, of uninterrupted work followed by a break. And I have a red light therapy device. So this hits like multiple things at one time. I have a red light therapy device that I actually use a lot, not so much for the therapy, like on my body, but for the light that it makes in the evening to like support my circadian rhythm. But it goes in 20 minutes. So I'll like set it for 20 minutes, I'll work. And then when it goes off, then I get up and I like clean something in the apartment, and then I come back. And that's like the pattern that works for me. And I know you talk about like finding what works for you for focus. So that's my pattern. Do you have a work focus pattern?
I have used Pomodoro a lot, and I don't think there's anything like magic about the Pomodoro ratio. You do 20 or 25 minutes and then take a 5-minute break, and you do that in multiple cycles. And then after you've done 2 hours, you take a longer break. The most important thing actually is that while you're doing the work thing, you're only doing work or whatever it is you're trying to focus on. So if it's a piece of writing or a piece of research, you know, reading something, writing a presentation, all you're doing is that, right? So ideally, you don't have notifications, you don't have email open, you have your phone turned over at least so you can't see stuff pop up on the screen. You get work done in that block, and then when you take your break, you're truly taking a break, right? So going and cleaning something is a great example. Like, you can still do something, but you're like completely cognitively moving away from what you're trying to work on, and then you can go back and do another stint. And you know, there's like I said, there's no magic amount of time, but you know, that kind of time seems to be a good chunk of what, you know, for what people, most people can focus for, like 20 to 30 minutes at a time before they need a break. And there are other studies that have looked at different time balances, but something like that, especially if you're going to, and then if you're going to do an extended period of an hour or two, you know, breaking up into three or four chunks with little breaks in between seems to be really good. And it's just like, you know, in the book, I kind of relate it to sort of physical efforts you might do in the gym, right? If you're going to lift weights or you're going to do sprints, you can't do that forever. You need to kind of take a rest. The brain needs those rests as well. This is where then, you know, the work that you're doing is kind of integrated into other things, into a bigger picture. The sort of everything resets, and then you can go back and go again. But I think that's really important, is building in these periods of time where all you're doing is just focusing on one thing, and then you're taking a break afterwards. And yeah, if you have to do some multitasking, you have to do some emails and Zoom calls and all that other kind of stuff, also kind of schedule specific times for that, so it doesn't kind of bleed into your full day, which is then again when sort of like stress and some of these other things can start to creep up.
Okay, I'm realizing I might do a hybrid version then, because sometimes I'll be playing TV during my 20 minutes of working. And then when I clean the apartment, I like to listen to the audiobooks, which brings it back to work a little bit. But I guess I can always improve on things.
I think you'll have noticed that my whole kind of approach, like none of it is like saying like this thing is bad, you need to not do it, right? It's just about finding something that feels like it's sustainable, but then also that it's, you know, allowing you to be productive, but then also feel well rested and feel able to engage in the things that you need to engage in. So if like TV while you're working doesn't disrupt that, so like if I have TV on while I'm working, either I'm actually focusing properly and like the TV may as well be off because I'm not paying attention to it, or I pay attention to the TV and I don't get the work done, right? So I can't do that. But if you can do that, like I'm not going to say that's bad, right? Everybody needs to find whatever pattern works for them. So I like to listen to drum and bass while I work. Other people would be climbing the walls with stress if they listen to my playlist. So like this is just, it's just about finding what sort of allows you to focus, feel productive, feel good, feel rested, and, you know, able to continue.
For me, it depends on like the type of work. And it's so true. So if it's like really focused work, I actually won't, the TV might be on, but I won't take any of it in. But if it's like more casual work that I can do with it on, then I take in, you know, different aspects of it. I think actually there's probably two things in my life that really support that focus, like that uninterrupted focus. And one is podcasting. So, you know, I get to have these conversations where, I mean, I don't know how I could do something else and and have the conversation. The other one is one that I think used to be maybe seen and probably is still seen as, I don't know, maybe lazy, maybe like not a positive thing for one's health. And now I actually think it's the opposite, because it's one of the few things that people still do where they turn off their phones, presumably for an extended period of time, and that's going to a movie theater to see a movie. I so appreciate going to a movie theater because it you actually turn off your phones and like watch a movie.
You know, I genuinely think there's lots of good things about, you know, watching a movie, and you can put it in a similar bucket. It's not quite the same, but you can put it in a similar bucket to like reading a book, right? There's fiction. It's a novel environment, like new things. You have to like follow a story. Sometimes you try and figure out what's going on. Like this, and right, you're doing just one thing at a time, and it's very rare for us to do that nowadays. So even if you put a movie on the TV at home, right, all of a sudden like you're scrolling Instagram at the same time, or you're like looking at emails. And I think going to a movie theater is a great thing to do, you know, once in a while. I think it, you know, gives you a good break. You're doing one thing at a time. Movies are a very, you know, interesting and cognitively engaging thing. I don't think it's like a proper cognitive challenge necessarily, but that kind of stuff can be, you know, replenishing and and beneficial.
Yeah. And then speaking to the, we mentioned AI earlier, I am also super aware of, and you mentioned the book that you read, you wrote your book the old school way.
No AIs were used in the writing of my book.
I hope I'm not in denial. I feel like the way I engage with AI, I like to use it to outsource the tasks where I don't, it would have taken me so much longer in the past to do it. Yes, it would have been cognitively stimulating and required focus for me to do these things that I outsourced to it. But by outsourcing that, I don't like the word but, and by outsourcing that, I can then do something else more complex on top of it. So as long as I'm, at least for me, I feel like, I hope, as long as I'm using it to do things that, yes, I could do, but by doing them, that now I can go on to the next more complex step that I will do. Hopefully that's using it in a beneficial way. Like, what do you think is how AI is affecting people's brains?
Yeah, so I think that's one of two good universal approaches to the use of AI or any like technological tool, right? Like most of them are going to be AI based, but certainly, you know, we could broaden this out to other types of technology. Plus, this is kind of part of a framework going forwards, because we don't know, like, what's AI going to look like in 6 months? Like, literally, who knows? So we can't, but so we have to think about frameworks rather than some like hard and fast rules, because it's just going to change so quickly. So we've definitely seen so far that in studies where they've had, and a lot of it's in students doing things like writing essays or, you know, looking at how much they learn, what you see is that if you use some kind of large language model from the outset to, say, write an essay for you rather than writing the essay yourself. And so there was one study that's gotten a lot of press. It was done at MIT. It was students writing essays. They were randomized to three different groups. One group just had to write the essay based on whatever they had in their head. Another group was allowed to use a search engine. And a third group was allowed to use a large language model. I think they used ChatGPT. What they found was that as you go up those levels of technological support, the brain networks associated with writing the essay were less activated. The students felt less ownership of their work. The work was more generic, and they remembered it less well. And this makes perfect sense. You haven't engaged your brain in the process, so why would your brain remember it or feel ownership of it? Like, this is entirely as expected. So the way that I interpret that is, and this is very similar to, you know, thinking about detraining with physical activity and how that changes physical function. You know, it goes all the way to the stimulus idea we talked about at the beginning. If there's some set of skills that you want to maintain or build in the first place, do not use AI to do it for you, because you will never learn that skill. Or if you have that skill, you will de-skill, because you're not actively engaging that skill anymore. I think that makes perfect sense. I think that shouldn't be particularly controversial. What's interesting is that when you there was another group, or like a follow-up part to this study, where the students who had previously written the essay themselves then got access to ChatGPT and were asked to write the essay again. And those essays ended up being a higher, better quality. And so how I would use it, or one of the ways I would use it, is say, I've got this piece of work. I'm going to do it myself. I'm going to write it. I'm going to build it. I'm going to code it, whatever it is. And then I would say to ChatGPT or Claude or whatever your favorite algorithm is, here's what I've done. Or you don't need to input it, but you can just say, like, I'm doing this. Like, this is what I've thought. This is what I've included. What have I missed? What could I do differently? What could be better? What else should I be thinking about? Something like that, right? So you use it almost as like a sort of like to give you feedback, or it's somewhere where you can like talk through your ideas or what you've done. Then it would give you feedback, and you would incorporate that feedback. Again, you would do the incorporation yourself, right? So it's almost like you've sent it to a friend to read over it, and they've given you some ideas. But this can happen, you know, in much shorter feedback loops, plus maybe with a bigger, you know, database of knowledge behind it. All of that requires you to build and maintain the actual skills to do the thing that you're trying to do. And the product ends up being better because you get additional input and additional thoughts and ideas. So that, I think, is the best of both worlds. So that's one way to use it. And then the other way is kind of as you outlined, which is that sometimes we have to do tedious, repetitive tasks where if we can have AI do it for us, and that frees up time so that we can actually do other things that maybe we enjoy more or are more cognitively stimulating, then as long as we do actually do that with that time, we can get additional benefit there. So to kind of finish this, there's an analogy that was developed by a friend of mine, Ken Ford. He's been an expert in the field of AI for at least 30 years at this point. And he talks about this idea of cognitive orthotics versus cognitive prosthetics. And an orthotic is something that you use to enhance your current function. So when I think of orthotics, you know, probably because of some of the research I do, I think about kids with cerebral palsy. They're, you know, they have some issues with motor control, so maybe it makes it hard for them to walk. But if you give them a certain type of orthotic shoe, that changes the structure of the foot slightly, or the biomechanics slightly, and it allows them to walk, right? So that orthotic is building their, it's increasing their capacity. It's allowing them to walk. Whereas a prosthetic is something that you use if you don't have that function at all. So, right, you have a prosthetic leg if you're missing parts or all of your leg. So if we use AI as an orthotic, we use it that first way I described to kind of build on our capacity. We do whatever we're capable of to start with, and then we have AI help us build on that. But again, we're fully engaged in that process. Rather than using it as a prosthetic where it's like using AI as a brain as if we didn't have a brain. You know what I mean? And so that's how I would approach it. Just think about, is my use of AI allowing me to augment or build my skills, or is it allowing my skills to atrophy because I'm not actually challenging myself or using my brain at all? And then the third kind of option is it's freeing up time so I can do more challenging, interesting things with my brain. So I think your approach is fine. This is certainly nothing against people using AI. It's just thinking about how is it helping or hurting the skills that I want my brain to have, and then just leveraging it in the best possible way.
Another resource for you guys. If you struggle with food sensitivities like I do, you have got to get my app, FoodSense Guide. It's a comprehensive catalog of over 300 foods for 11 potentially problematic compounds. These include things you may be reacting to, like gluten, lectins, FODMAPs, histamine, oxalates, sulfites, thiols, whether or not something is a nightshade, and so much more. It even includes autoimmune paleo AIP status. You can learn about the compounds, create your own list to share and print, and finally take charge of your food sensitivities. It is a top Apple app, often in the top 10 for the Apple food and drinks charts. And friends, get it now, because I'm going to be updating it to a subscription basis soon. So you definitely want to get grandfathered in for life at one super low price. With the subscriptions, by the way, I'm going to be implementing some pretty cool features. So I need to do subscriptions to help support that. So like I said, get it now before we change to subscriptions. You can get it at melanieavalon.com/foodsenseguide.
One of the places I get concerned is I think people use it a lot. It's like when you're talking to somebody on text, you know, through emails or something, it's like, am I even talking to this person, or is it just our avatar AIs talking to each other that got a stamp of approval from us to send? Although I will say something that I feel very grateful for AI is I used to stress a lot about typos in emails from my end, but now I'm like, if I put a typo, that just shows that it's a real person talking. I sometimes wonder if people like put in typos on purpose so that it is obvious that it's not AI. I might have done that on occasion.
That's interesting. I guess I'd never really thought about that. But I mean, that does make a lot of sense. Like, obviously, if there's a typo, it was, or at least there was some cortical input from a human. I will say that I don't ever use AI to write emails, because I can tell when somebody sends me an email, I can tell that they didn't write it. And I'm like, what even was the point of this communication? And I think, even though email is a relatively impersonal form of communication, and obviously, you know, voice and then video and then in person, sort of in that order, are more meaningful forms of communication, I still think that email is a very important form of communication. So if I'm going to send you a message, I'm going to write it myself. And yes, that's it takes more time, but that's still important to me as like a skill of interacting with other humans.
Me too. And I'm major team emoji.
Oh yeah, me too. Yeah. That saves us time. Do you know what? Somebody, I was listening to somebody recently where I think it was on a podcast where somebody was complaining about the use of emojis. And then the guest was like, well, actually, one thing that's missing from written communication is facial expressions. And so there's some evidence that emojis allow us to understand the meaning of the person slightly better and engage with it slightly more because we're bringing back some of that kind of non-verbal communication that we get like from face-to-face communication. So like that made me feel better about my emojis because I love a good emojis, a good emoji response.
I could talk for like 2 hours, my love of emojis. I think they are so important. Like for that reason, because with text, like if it's just text, people read the text and the vibe that they're thinking. Not, they don't know the vibe, and I don't like the word vibe, it's very casual, but you know, they put onto the words the tone and intonation that they're thinking. And so the only way around that, in my opinion, is to splatter all the emojis all the time. Like,
it's also why I love exclamation points. Like literally my emails and texts are full of exclamation points because in general, I'm a very expressive, positive person. And like, that's how I can get that across in text. And when I was writing my book proposal, my agent was like, you just can't use this many exclamation points. I think my book proposal was 25,000 words long. And there was one exclamation point that she let me keep. And I think in the book, there's maybe two or three because like, you know, in the formal, you know, the formal written book world, it's frowned upon to have every sentence end in an exclamation point. But when I'm like communicating with other people, I use them a lot.
So two quick thoughts. One is I had an epiphany about exclamation points, and it's when I was thinking about the people reading things and the tone that they read it. And I realized, oh, when I use exclamation points, there must be an emoji because otherwise people might think I'm yelling at them, you know, without excitement. So whenever I'm like exclamation points, include the emoji. I think one of my other favorite, words is aposiopesis. Have you heard this word?
I have not.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So it is the concept of the dot, dot, dot. So it's when you talk and then that would be aposiopesis, what I just did. So it's like, I love when there's like a word that describes a concept that you didn't even know was a concept and there's a word for it.
That is very cool. So that makes me think a little bit of one of the things that my wife and I bonded over when we first met was various uses of grammar and punctuation. So like I'm a massive proponent of the Oxford comma. Very important to me.
Me too. Team Oxford comma.
Both of our favorite piece of punctuation is the interrobang, which also just has an amazing, amazing name. So that's the question mark exclamation point together is formally called an interrobang.
I didn't know there was a word for that.
Yeah. See, there's another cool word that you didn't really... Yeah.
Yes, the interrobang. I'm going to start integrating that into my vernacular. Okay. This has been amazing. We don't have to do a deep dive. Just one really last quick question. And I don't even know if it's a question. Maybe I'll just state it and then you can let me know your thoughts. But on the nicotine and alcohol side of things... So the daughter of the woman who led the Mind Diet trial, they came out with a book, like the official Mind Diet, I think a few years, like a year or two ago. So I had them on the show, and of course I'm a big wine fan. So I've always loved that the Mind Diet includes wine as you get positive points for it for cognitive health. I appreciated, not because I'm biased, but I appreciated your take on alcohol in the book. I feel like people are often... And you, I think you started off by saying this, which I thought was so brilliant. You said something to the effect of people, when they ask about alcohol, it's either because they want to justify, you know, not drinking at all, or they want to justify drinking a lot. I was like, that tracks pretty, yeah. Alcohol in the brain. Can I have my nightly glass of wine?
I would say, yeah, so I agree that we've gotten to this point where sort of the kind of the focus on alcohol in health has shifted from oh yeah, this, you know, the nightly glass of red wine is really good for us. Now it's shifted over to any alcohol is bad. And it's like this super puritanical approach. And in reality, neither of those are true. And so if I were scoring the Mind Diet, I wouldn't include alcohol in it. I don't think there's a net benefit to regular alcohol consumption. But equally, if it's infrequent or small amounts, there isn't a net negative, right? It's essentially neutral. So everything that we see from an overall health perspective, if you're drinking, you know, less than one drink a day on average, and you kind of have to calibrate based on the country that the research was done in, because one US standard drink is 14 grams of ethanol. One UK unit, which is, and a lot of the recent studies have come out of the UK Biobank, one UK unit is 8 grams of ethanol. So a unit in the UK is about half a US standard drink. But if you're consuming less than a UK unit of alcohol a day, so that's an alcohol, you know, a US standard drink every other day on average, there's essentially no net effect on the brain, positive or negative, right? No increase in dementia risk, no change in brain volume, brain structure. Above that, brain volume does start to decline, dementia risk does start to increase. When you look at other health outcomes at that kind of level, cardiovascular disease risk decreases a little bit, but that's balanced out by a slight increase in stroke and maybe some cancers. So again, like no net effect. So if you're, you know, drink, you know, a small glass of wine a night on average, you know, that's probably fine. I think that's within those parameters. But, you know, we're talking like, you know, just like 3 or 4 ounces or something, right? Like genuinely a small glass. Like that's certainly within those parameters. And then, you know, there's other things that could come from that, right? Maybe it's in a social setting. Maybe it does truly help you to relax and switch off. I would argue that you don't need alcohol to do that, but you can. So there could be some potential benefit there. But equally, we also know that, you know, alcohol impairs certain aspects of sleep, partly by affecting REM sleep, partly by affecting thermoregulation at night. Maybe that's why you have your bedroom at 62 degrees. So in reality, like what I say is like one or two drinks once or twice a week is absolutely fine. And I think the evidence really shows that quite clearly. I don't think that it should have been included in the Mind Diet. Like if I was doing the Mind Diet, I wouldn't have included alcohol. But what I will say is there have been some very nice studies that have looked at all the components of Mediterranean style diets. And it wasn't the Mind Diet specifically, but it was other scores of the Mediterranean diet, which included red wine. And they looked at dementia risk. And what they found was that no individual component of the diet was responsible for the benefit of a Mediterranean style eating pattern and dementia risk. So if you remove red wine, you still see benefit. If you add red wine, it doesn't negate the benefit, if that makes sense. Because it's really the overall pattern that's important. Higher quality, less calorie dense, more nutrient dense foods, more fiber, more protein, more nutrients, etc. So your nightly glass of wine is almost certainly fine. I think that there's probably no net effect one way or the other.
I'm also neurotic about like low alcohol, organic, high polyphenol. One of the things in all the alcohol literature in general that I think is important that nobody talks about is that it's often just like alcohol as a group, or it's like wine or beer, but it doesn't take into account the actual drink. So like does it have other toxins in it? What is the alcohol content itself? Because it can range so much.
Yeah, that's why I always talk in units and drinks, because then you're sort of standardizing the amount of alcohol. And that's also how because that's an important part. Plus, you can certainly have your much higher polyphenol wines. Whether that's enough polyphenols to have a large biological effect is, I think, potentially debatable. Although there's probably better studies on, say, wild blueberries or cherries or strawberries. You have a cup or two of those, you're getting enough polyphenols to have a measurable benefit on terms of cognitive function, both acutely and long term. So we know that these polyphenols that you're getting from berries are having benefits for the brain. I would prefer them as a bowl of blueberries. But equally, I also enjoy a Manhattan when I go out for date night with my wife. So I certainly stick to those same alcohol parameters that I just mentioned.
Awesome. Yeah. And I wear a fourth of a nicotine patch every day because I like the way I've never smoked or anything, but I like the way it makes my brain feel. But it's a very low dose. Yeah. Do you have thoughts on nicotine?
Nicotine is interesting because it's become this, it's become sort of like this new nootropic, or people call it a nootropic, even though it's not a nootropic. For a nootropic to be a nootropic, it has to improve brain function with no downsides or negative side effects, and also not result in tolerance, where you need a higher dose to get the same effect, or dependence, where you get withdrawal if you don't take it. And like, nicotine doesn't hit any of those. Same for caffeine, right? Caffeine is not a nootropic either. So, and I very much enjoy my coffee in the morning. So there are studies that show that in both people who do and don't smoke, giving them nicotine does improve some aspects of cognitive function, right? Particularly related to focus and attention, and maybe some aspects of working memory, because acetylcholine, you know, particularly in sort of like the areas of the, you know, the prefrontal or frontal areas of the brain, is really important for signaling attention and focus. So you do get some improvements with nicotine. The only reason why I have concerns about chronic nicotine use is for those other reasons that I mentioned, right? You get withdrawal or dependence. The kind of the doses that you're describing, I think are probably absolutely fine. But we have people now who are taking potentially hundreds of milligrams of nicotine a day because it's so easy to get it through pouches and vapes and things like that. So and vapes themselves have some potential health issues. They're probably, yeah, I mean, they're certainly better than smoking tobacco, but you know, they do have some potential health effects as well. So yes, there's very interesting data on the acute effects of nicotine administration, but usually it's like a one-off dose in one study. They haven't sort of looked at chronic low-level administration in healthy people in the kind of way that you're describing. So it's mainly an unknown. That's one of the reasons why I don't recommend it routinely. But as long as you're not escalating the dose, not getting withdrawal symptoms, there's probably minimal downsides at sort of very low doses.
Yeah, I think mine is the equivalent because I cut it in four and it's 12 milligrams. So it's like 3 milligrams and it's slow release. So like 3 milligrams over the entire day. Wow. Okay. Well, I think we got to like 15%. No, we got a ton done. And listeners, honestly, we only barely scratched the surface of everything in this book. So go get this Stimulated Mind now. I will say, if you want to remember, there's a whole section on memory in the book that we didn't talk about that. But if you want to remember anything from today's show, I think there were so many studies that you talked about, but I think my favorite study that was the most mind-blowing to me was the one where they had the two groups of students and they were studying material and they let one group read the material and then like reread it. I don't know how many times they reread it, but then the other group only read it once and then they just tried to remember what they had read. And then that group, they remembered it better later. Was that what happened?
Yeah, that's right. So this is a classic study in memory where, yeah, so students could either, or they were randomized to either, I think they read the material up to, they read it and then read it up to a three additional times, or they just read it once and all they did was try to remember it.
And they weren't even told if they were correct or not, right?
No, that's right.
That's the mind-blowing part. I was like, whoa, exclamations.
You know, there's been a ton of additional studies for why this might happen. And a very good book, if you're particularly interested in memory, is Why We Remember by Charan Ranganath. And he's done a little bit of work where basically by trying to remember it, you're sort of engaging all the machinery it's really the reactivation of those same synapses involved in the formation of the memory that creates, you know, that strengthens them. Whereas if you're just rereading the material, particularly if you've recently read it, you're like, oh yeah, I just read this. You're not really engaging that machinery, whereas you really engage it when you try to remember something. And there's some other really fascinating studies where, which I didn't talk about in the book, but the one study where people are trying to remember pairs of words what you would learn is you would learn kind of a trigger word. And from the trigger word, you had to remember the paired word. And what they did initially, in one group was just, have them, just memorize the word pairs. But in another group, they had them come up with the paired word they were supposed to remember first without knowing what it was. So like, if the pair is like apple shoe, and I give you the trigger word apple, and you're like, oh, the paired word is going to be tree, and then you learn it shoe, you actually remember shoe better, even though initially you created this idea of tree. And that's because you've created an infrastructure that you can then correct and say, oh no, it's actually shoe, and you combine those things together. And there's yet another study where they had people answering general knowledge questions, and they then had them estimate how right they were or how confident they were in their answer. And people who were wrong, but were more confident in their wrongness, when they then learned the actual answer, they remembered it better. So making a bigger mistake that you're more confident in then actually created a better anchor for you to sort of add the right answer to. So just like lots of these really cool studies about how it's truly doing things to engage that process of memory and creating a structure to that memories can be bound to, whether that's being wrong about something or just thinking about trying to remember what it was you learned, actually allows you to remember better.
That makes sense, especially because, yeah, when you're so sure about something and then you find out you're wrong, I feel like I never forget it.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, so listeners, just try to remember what you learned in today's conversation. Don't even have to re-listen to it. No. But this has been absolutely amazing. So thank you so much for your time, Tommy, and everything that you're doing. How can people get the book, follow your work? You're working on a lot of stuff in your lab that you've talked about. So what all would you like to put out there for listeners?
Thanks so much for having me. We covered a lot of ground that I actually don't frequently cover in podcasts. So that was really cool to do. So yeah, the book is The Stimulated Mind. It's available wherever you buy books. You can go to thestimulatedmind.com for more details. That actually links to a part of my website, which is drtommywood.com. And then my Instagram is where I post most of my podcasts and studies and papers and things that come out. So that's at Dr. Tommy Wood on Dr. Tommy Wood on Instagram. And I also have a Substack and a podcast called Better Brain Fitness. You can go to betterbrain.fitness and you can sign up for the free version. All the content is the same, regardless of whether it's the free or paid version. And yeah, I share that with my colleague, Josh Turknet, who I mentioned earlier. And the podcast is like a Q&A style. So any questions you have, submit them there, and we slowly work through them across our episodes.
Oh, perfect. Especially because I did have like a dozen listener questions for you, but did not get to any of those. So listeners, submit them directly to Tommy on his podcast, and we will put links to all that in the show notes. And thank you again so much. The last question that I ask every single guest on this show, super easy. It's just because I'm very much obsessed with gratitude and mindset. So what is something that you're grateful for?
I am really grateful for the people who supported me to allow me to do to write the book and then sort of get out into the world. So that's the people who work in my lab. I have several research staff and students who do all the hard work in the lab so that I can be traveling around the world speaking to Joe Rogan and writing the book. So I'm really grateful for them. And then also my wife, who took on a ton of additional house care and other duties so that I could be out there first writing the book and then promoting it. So I'm incredibly grateful to all of them.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. I will be eagerly looking forward to all of your future work. And yeah, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed this. My brain feels stimulated. So goal accomplished. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information and resources, you can check out my book, What, When, Wine, as well as my supplement line, Avalon X. Please visit melanieavalon.com to learn more about today's guest, and always feel free to contact me at contact@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.